today on Annenberg Radio News.
I was basically trying to counteract what Iraq did to me through taking these pictures. I was basically fighting all the feelings, or the loss of feelings.
One young veteran uses photography to deal with his traumatic experiences on the battlefield. Good afternoon from the University of Southern California, and welcome to Annenberg Radio News for Thursday, April 12, 2012. I'm Benjamin Gottlieb. USC and LAPD plan to offer a $125,000 reward tomorrow for information leading to an arrest in the shooting of two graduate students from China. The students were killed yesterday morning on Raymond Avenue, just west of campus. Police are looking for a suspect and a motive for the shooting. One theory is that it was a carjacking gone bad. The shooting has shaken up students, parents, and neighborhood residents, and as Conrad Wilton reports, many Chinese students are reevaluating their own safety living in South LA.
The shooting on Raymond Avenue left two USC graduate students dead and thousands of others grappling for answers. Pei Shen is a graduate student from China studying communication. She says she does not feel completely safe living or even driving in South LA.
I'm kind of scared because I drove my car. When I drove my car, I said, at least I'm safe in my car. But now I think even I'm in the car, I'm not safe.
Shen says her fears intensify when she ventures west of Vermont.
Because there's no lights, no people walking around. I'm really scared, actually.
As more students move farther from campus and safety concerns grow, some USC students criticize Chinese media outlets for headlining the fact that the victims were driving a brand new BMW. They say that focusing on the BMW faults the victims for driving an expensive car and making themselves targets. A USC graduate student and writer for the U.S.-China Institute who asked to remain anonymous says the media should reveal all the information they can to the public, including information describing the BMW.
We understand that news media should, like, send out some information about this incident, so they might talk about the brand of the car, etc.
The age of the BMW is also in dispute. Many news reports say the car was new, but the LA Times quoted friends of the victims who say the BMW was a 2003 model. Catherine Zhou is a first-year graduate student. She says although the Chinese press is focusing on the BMW, she blames the American media.
Because I saw a newspaper in China, it seems they recite resources from the U.S. newspapers. They don't know the truth.
At USC, the Department of Public Safety is hosting an online forum where students and parents can ask officers questions about bolstering safety in the neighborhood. This is Conrad Wilton, Annenberg Radio News.
Solar power generation in Los Angeles just got a lot easier through an ordinance signed by Mayor Antonio Villaraigosa today. The test program allows the Department of Water and Power to pay businesses and residents for solar power they contribute to the LA power grid. Our own Melissa Runnels breaks it down for us.
LA is a really sunny place. It gets up to 278 days of sunshine a year. So you'd think LA would be a major player in developing solar power. But the city hasn't gotten as far as you might think. The DWP is still one of the dirtiest utilities in the states, getting almost half of its power from coal. And that doesn't fit in with Mayor Villaraigosa's vision of making LA the greenest city in America. He's throwing his weight behind solar power.
We use more solar energy. We use less dirty coal.
Today, Villaraigosa, a born and bred Angeleno, signed an ordinance empowering the DWP to test a new feed-in tariff program. It allows solar panel providers to team up with building owners to set up solar arrays and sell the power generated back to the DWP. City Councilman Eric Garcetti partnered with the mayor to write the ordinance.
A feed-in tariff program allows somebody to go to multiple businesses or somebody who owns huge warehouses throughout the region and to be able to go to them and say, look, I will make a deal with DWP if you give me the top of your roofs. The business makes a little something, that solar provider makes something, and the people of LA have better, greener energy.
But the devil's in the detail, says Adam Browning of Vote Solar, a San Francisco green energy policy group. Proposed projects have to be doable.
As long as there are strong project viability requirements in that market-based approach, that is to say that you make sure that the projects that are bid in are real projects.
The feed-in tariff is a test program to work out those details. If all goes well, the program will be ramped up next year. And it's not just good government, it's personal for the mayor.
You know, I remember when I couldn't get out of my classroom. Mm-hmm. They'd keep you in your classroom because the air was so dirty.
And he clearly hopes he'll be leaving a lasting legacy.
As we go, so goes the state and the nation.
With business, labor, and neighborhood groups behind it, proponents think this can serve as a model for the nation. For Annenberg Radio News, I'm Melissa Runnels.
Los Angeles City Controller Wendy Gruhl released her audit today of the troubled Los Angeles Memorial Coliseum Commission. As Nick Edmonds reports, Gruhl hopes the audit can bring positive change for the storied institution.
Years of fraud and mismanagement of the LA Memorial Coliseum have finally boiled over, resulting in an audit by City Controller Wendy Gruhl. The audit comes in the wake of an investigation of several officers of the Memorial Coliseum Commission, including former stadium general manager Patrick Lynch. Lynch was one of six officers charged last month in a 29-count indictment alleging bribery and embezzlement. Gruhl says the controversy is one for the record books.
What's clear is that the management controls over the Coliseum spending were weak or non-existent, resulting in millions of dollars in wasteful spending, fraudulent activity, and misuse of funds.
Gruhl says the largest example of fraud occurred when Lynch issued hundreds of thousands of dollars in advance payments for Uruguayan soccer teams to play at the Coliseum.
Despite paying more than $870,000 in unreturned deposits, none of these events ever occurred, and no contracts for the events were ever formally approved by the commission board.
If the games never took place, what happened to all the money?
More than $75,000 in bonuses were paid to employees outside of the city's payroll system that were filed improperly with the IRS.
Lynch even managed to give himself the maximum bonus of $125,000 from 2007 to 2010, despite the Coliseum's declining profitability. The Coliseum took a financial hit when it dropped four rave concerts popular among USC students.
The average rent for the four most prominent raves held at the Coliseum declined significantly, while those same events' gross ticket sales increased significantly. They made a lot of money, those festivals. The Coliseum did not.
With such public mismanagement damaging the commission's reputation, USC could take advantage and throw its hat in the ring for Coliseum ownership. The university has been trying to own the Coliseum for years. Gruhl isn't sold on the notion, but knows that some sort of change is a must.
I don't know all of the details of the USC deal. I think what is clear is that the current structure of the Coliseum Commission doesn't work, and that we need to look at other alternatives, and everything should be on the table.
Though Gruhl is unsure of the future of the Coliseum, she is sure of one thing. As long as she remains controller, a crime like this will never happen again. Nick Edmonds, Annenberg Radio News.
Sorry for the technical difficulties. The California Supreme Court ruled today that employers are not obligated to make sure workers take legally mandated meals and rest breaks. The unanimous opinion says employers are at liberty to use the break periods as they choose. This ruling follows a case filed 9 years ago against Brinker International, which owns Chili's and other restaurant chains. California is one of the few states that impose a monetary penalty for employers who violate these laws. And now for the weather. We're expecting overnight showers across much of the Southland and temperatures in the low 50s. For tomorrow, I'd bring your umbrella to work. Showers are expected throughout the day, with winds swirling around 25 miles per hour. However, the rain should be gone by Saturday, leaving us sunny skies and temperatures in the mid-60s. Later on Annenberg Radio News, we remember the musical legacy of iconic singer Woody Guthrie. Today, Latino and LGBT organizations rallied outside a Beverly Hills restaurant that, they say, fired an employee because he was HIV positive. Rosalie Murphy reports from The Ivy.
This is the spot, The Ivy, a Beverly Hills restaurant that's the place to see and be seen. It's bordered by a picket fence and littered with celebrities and paparazzi.
The Ivy Restaurant! Remember,
And these are the chants of two dozen protesters pacing Robertson Boulevard outside the restaurant today. Latino and LGBT activist groups met at the Ivy during the lunch rush to support Raimundo Martinez, the busboy who lost his job last year. He started lawsuit proceedings 2 weeks ago.
We're here because we think it's unfair that someone be fired just because of their HIV status.
Erica Reyes of the Wall Las Memorias, a Latino HIV education group.
And the fact that this man is HIV positive and was let go of his job, I mean, it's discrimination. I mean,
the case began when Martinez started taking new medication with unexpected side effects. In January 2011, he had to leave a shift early. He took the rest of the week off and brought the Ivy a doctor's note requesting a schedule change. But 5 days later, the restaurant let him go. The Ivy management says the restaurant did not know Martinez lived with HIV. Brian Moulton, legal director at LGBT advocacy organization Human Rights Campaign, says the 1990 Americans with Disabilities Act made employment discrimination against people with HIV/AIDS illegal. Restaurants tried to opt out of the requirement then, but Moulton says they've never been exempt, even though people worry that HIV could be transmitted more easily through food.
Courts have largely rejected it, and that there's, you know, some sort of threat for an individual working in a food service position that they might transmit HIV. That hasn't stood up when it's been brought up as an argument in the past.
Longtime HIV/AIDS activist Eric Gordon says today reminds him of the old days a little too much.
This seems like a throwback in a way. I mean, I remember demonstrations, you know, like this 20 years ago. When people were demonstrating, you know, for employment rights, for insurance rights, for health care. So, you know, a lot of those struggles have been won in the tradition of that struggle. This goes on, and even at, in Beverly Hills. And so it's shameful.
The court has not yet begun proceedings on Martinez's complaint. Rosalie Murphy, Annenberg Radio News.
Crenshaw Boulevard has been the home of the Dharmavyaha Buddhist Temple for more than 30 years. Yet not many people know that it's there. Devin Alschul reports.
On busy Crenshaw Boulevard, there lies peace and tranquility in the large orange house on the corner. With a Buddha statue and large paper lanterns on the porch, it is unlike all the other homes on the block. This house is the Dharmavyaha Buddhist Temple, where you can hear chanting every day. The temple moved from Hollywood to Crenshaw in 1980 after facing religious and racial intolerance. The abbot and founder of the temple, Walpola Piananda, said he has never felt unwelcome in Crenshaw.
I found out these locations, beautiful houses, neighbors are wonderful, not making any difficulties. Fortunately, this neighborhood, we didn't get any trouble.
Crenshaw Boulevard is the home of many other churches and denominations. However, many residents in the area don't know the temple or any practice of Buddhism even exists. As a local Crenshaw reporter, Brian Carter said he'd never heard of any Buddhism in the area.
I think most people, from what I know in this area, will probably be Christian, either Baptist, Methodist, mostly Protestant Christian within the area. I had no idea there were any Buddhist temples or anything Buddhist in Crenshaw, period.
There are over 400 Buddhist temples in the Los Angeles area, but only a few people practice and come to Piananda from Crenshaw.
Here, most of people are coming in Sri Lankan community, born Buddhist families, Thai people, sometimes other ethnicities.
The Dharmavyaha Temple offers spiritual advice, religious counseling, and meditation. They don't advertise within the community and are open to all religions.
Buddhism, we are not trying to convert anyone to our religions. If anyone needs any assistance, we help them.
After 32 years, the Dharmavyaha Temple has become a permanent fixture in Crenshaw and is helping give back to a community that knows little about its existence. Devin Auchel, Annenberg Radio News.
Veterans and the American public have different views on the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, the value of military service, and even the subject of patriotism. For 26-year-old Jason Kellogg, it's the public's attitude towards war that has kept him from successfully transitioning back to civilian life. As part of our series on 20-somethings, Arzu Rezvani brings us the story.
Students in a psychology class at USC erupt into laughter.
But one sits there, unamused by the joke. Jason Kellogg lets out a sigh.
Like, you realize you're in a completely different world, and no one has any idea of, like, what you've been through. So you feel that. You feel this distinction, you know?
Jason is one of the 1.5 million young soldiers who've returned from war in the last decade. It's been 4 years since Jason returned from 2 deployments in Iraq, but he's still struggling to readjust. It was pretty bad at first. A stranger's gaze held too long, or the early morning groans from a neighborhood garbage truck took him back in time.
Cars driving by fast, or being in a place you don't know, or like if I left the neighborhood, like if I drove my car outside of Santa Monica, I'd have a lot of anxiety. And I would notice it like in my driving, and then that's when I realized there's something wrong.
Jason needed help, and understanding that was the first step. Reluctantly at first, he started seeing a social worker at the VA, someone who understood his trauma.
It's like a blank canvas, and you can kind of throw things up against it and see what happens.
Jason says a key to his adjustment has been trying to understand the reasons for joining the Marines in the first place, which he says had much to do with exploring the outer bounds of his masculinity.
I mean, for a young man, like when I was 17 or 16, like I'm trying to figure out like who I am as a man, and nothing in my culture gave me that except the military.
Looking back, he has also come to understand the bigger picture, that soldiers and the public they try to defend simply don't see eye to eye.
I think the military and the infantry is politically incorrect. Their job is just to kill as effectively and quickly as possible. Well, that's the exact opposite of how it works in the day-to-day culture in America. Like, if someone has a problem, like, you try to talk it out. You try to come to some sort of consensus. Well, that philosophy is the inverse of war. And that's why people don't understand it.
For Jason, the healing actually began when he was still stationed in Iraq, where he started to sense that his humanity was deeply intertwined with the humanity of the ordinary Iraqis he came across every day. On his second tour of duty, he brought a camera along, and in 2010, self-published a book of photographs. Children of War was put on exhibit last year on the USC campus. He recovers the book from underneath a pile of newspapers on his coffee table and thumbs through the pages, stopping at an image of a young girl.
The girl with the green sweater, you can see me in her eyes. As I look at her, I'm looking back at myself. And that's really what this whole thing was about. I was basically trying to counteract what Iraq did to me through taking these pictures. I was basically fighting all the feelings or the loss of feelings and trying to kind of recapture, you know, my humanity.
Marcus Saltero, a former advisor with the VA, says that understanding one's own experience, which Jason started through his photography, is what college can help do for others.
For some of these younger veterans that may have just joined straight out of high school who really don't know how to comprehend what they're going through, that education kind of puts them in a place where they can kind of cycle through that and comprehend what their experience is or what happened to them.
Take Jason's experience and multiply it by thousands, because last December, 8,000 troops left Iraq. Many of them, like Jason, will try the classroom.
I mean, the trick is to find a way in which you take those experiences that seem incomprehensible and like you can't find anything good and meaningful about them and integrate them into something in which they become very important and significant. And then when that takes place, then you're no longer a victim, you know, and I think that's what I'm doing. I actually have more humanity now than people here, because I know more of what it is to be a human being.
Arzu Rezvani, Annenberg Radio News.
Come gather around, people, wherever you roam.
This week marks the centennial celebration of America's iconic folk singer, Woody Guthrie. Today, the intersection of 4th and Main in downtown L.A. was named after the folk singer. Guthrie was a native of Oklahoma, but he lived in Los Angeles for a few years in the 1930s. His daughter, Nora Guthrie, was among the many to attend the ceremony this morning.
We've been following his footsteps from Oklahoma to Texas and now to Los Angeles. It was here that he met Will Geer, and they started going around singing and performing for the migrant workers to get them to organize into unions.
On Saturday, Los Angeles will honor Guthrie with a conference at USC and a concert at Club Nokia. I spoke with USC journalism professor Ed Cray, who wrote a biography about Guthrie, on what makes Guthrie such an important figure in American music history.
Guthrie is a seminal figure. He's a person who taught many people they could make a living singing their own songs. It may not be a great living, although some have made it. Woody certainly never made a lot of money in his life. The fact is that that is his greatest contribution. Now, then again, there are his songs, which are still sung, including the unofficial national anthem, This Land Is Your Land.
Absolutely. That's actually one of my favorite songs that I used to play as a camp counselor at a summer camp here in town. So why don't we give that a little listen?
This land is your land, and this land is my land, from the California to the New York Island.
You know, it's funny. I think that people don't really realize that that's Woody Guthrie. It's one of those few songs that actually transcends the artist. But outside of his music, he was known for his political activism during the Great Depression and also the Dust Bowl. He was referred to as the Dust Bowl Troubadour, which I think is a great term. Can you talk a little bit about the way that he portrayed the situation that many Americans were facing in the Midwest as they headed west?
Well, Woody, even before he got to California, was conscious of that there was a Great Depression, and in fact, that it was a Dust Bowl on top of a depression that sent many people to California. In fact, Woody himself, one of his first real song hits was Do Re Mi, which is illustrative also of a characteristic of Woody's songs, which are, there's always
Georgia,
humor.
Tennessee. California is a garden of Eden, a paradise to live in or see. But
some of America's most well-known artists of the 20th century, Bob Dylan, Pete Seeger, Bruce Springsteen, they all derived a lot of their influence from Woody Guthrie. Can you talk a little bit about the direct impact Guthrie's music had on these artists?
Well, I think Bob Dylan, when he went to New York City for the first time, he called himself a walking Woody Guthrie jukebox. that was essentially his repertoire was almost entirely Woody.
Now, Professor, we're also seeing a folk revival like we saw in the 50s and 60s today. Can you talk a little bit about where Woody Guthrie plays into this revival and if there's some sort of carryover?
Well, I think there is a carryover. I mean, clearly, I mean, you know, there's an impact on people like Mellencamp and Woody's son Arlo, who've carried this banner forward, if you will. Bruce Springsteen, in one sense, reflects Woody's influence, at least in the songwriting. It's clear that Springsteen shares Woody's love of country very deeply, and his defense of the underdog. I just think that, you know, summing it up, that Woody was a great influence.
That was USC's Ed Cray talking with us about Woody Guthrie. He will be speaking at Centennial Memorial event this Saturday at USC's Bovard Auditorium.
You may be surprised, people in this world are getting organized.
Animal lovers, rejoice. The California Senate voted unanimously today to allow a year-long extension of a campaign to raise money for spay and neuter programs. The campaign is sponsored by the California Veterinary Medical Board. It raises funds by selling specialty license plates. Supporters say spaying and neutering is the best way to alleviate pet overpopulation and reduce the euthanasia rate. Now we check in with Nuha Abujaber to see what's coming up on Annenberg TV News at 6 p.m. on Trojan Vision. Nuha?
So tonight on ATVN, George Zimmerman made his first court appearance 47 days after Trayvon Martin was shot and killed. We have a lot more on that at 6. Also, USC students are getting ready to head to the music festival Coachella, which is less than 24 hours away. That and a lot more tonight.
Nuha, are you going to the festival yourself?
I am. Are you?
I'm not, but I hope you have a good time.
Thank you.
Thank you, Nuha. Well, that's it for this Thursday. We had help today from ATVN and Madeline Lindsay. Esther King is our producer. Emily Frost is our executive producer. And from all of us here at Annenberg Radio News, I'm Benjamin Gottlieb. Thank you so much. Have a great weekend.